everybody. It's Su Lin. It's really, really nice to be here with you right now. This is an audio cast. It is all about flower anatomy. So for the next little while, I'm going to be running you through the different parts of a flower. This will be really interesting information for botany students, as well as anyone in herbal manufacturing dealing with the harvesting and manufacture of plants, particularly medicinal plants, because all of our information on Wild Medicine Academy is geared towards the natural medicine student. So we also have a 5-minuter, which is a very short video educational resource on flower anatomy, and that's available on our website. If you head to the top menu bar and you click down on the articles and videos link, you will find webinars in there, and you'll find all of our 5-minuters in there. We also have the 5-minuters available on our Vimeo channel and on our YouTube channel. So for more information on that, just have a look at the description and information that comes with this audio cast. But for now, green heart, just sit back and learn all about the parts of a flower. The takeaways for this audio cast are very similar to those in the 5-minuter on parts of a flower. Of course, we are able to expand and go into more detail. We'll be looking at viewing the flower as a collection of whorls, and this particular approach divides flower parts up into different sections, and each of those sections are defined, of course, by their physical characteristics, but more importantly by their function. And the function really does determine the form. We'll also look at differentiating a little bit more than you would find in the 5-minuter between different types of flowers based on that whorl structure and whether we call them perfect, imperfect, male, female, and so forth. So we can breathe and relax and enjoy learning in a little bit more detail about those different terms that can be used when describing flowers. It is a very, very hot day in Sydney right now. We've had the hottest 5 days in a row for the last decade. So I'm actually sitting in my office right now. I'm looking out on my herb garden, and I can see many plants here that are calling out to me because they're finding it really, really hard. The skullcap is looking like it's starting to weep a little bit. So yes, it's definitely time to get out there and cover up those plants. Certainly, it's getting a lot warmer in Australia, and a lot of the medicinal plants in our Western Materia Medica, I think, you know, we're just going to have to be a little bit more careful with those as the Aussie sun beats down on them. So I'm going to quickly go and pop a very light beach towel over some of my plants, and I'm going to be right back shortly to talk to you about flower anatomy. First thing that I want to talk about is flower structure, and there's a couple of ways in which we describe the structure of a flower. Sometimes we're looking purely at the different components that make up each individual flower, and this is the whorl structure, so that's what we're going to be talking about very soon. The other way to describe flowers is in terms of whether they grow solitarily or whether they grow in a group or a cluster. And when we're talking about growing in clusters, we are talking about inflorescences, which is a really different topic. So I will save that topic for a different audio cast because the inflorescences, we could go into quite a lot of detail about those. So flowers that grow on their own peduncle, a flower stem, they are known as solitary flowers. And we'll pretty much be describing all sorts of flowers today. So we won't necessarily be looking at solitary or inflorescence flowers, but we'll just be talking about the flower, just the individual flower, and describing the various components that make it up. So I mentioned before that the function of a flower determines its form. And the function of a flower is that it plays a reproductive role for the plant, and reproduction is really the only reason that the plant germinates. It germinates, grows, it develops, and always with the intention of seeding off future generations. So obviously, with many different plants, we have a whole different host of flower types, different flower designs, different colors, different ways that flowers form. And really, there is so much variety because the plant kingdom has developed so many intricate ways to enhance its ability to reproduce and therefore to ensure survival of species. So we have the fact that the flowers are the reproductive organs of a plant, and that explain perhaps why they are so eye-catching, why they're often the focus for us, for pollinators, of a plant, that they are really there to capture attention and to draw any possible means of reproduction towards the plant. Often that is insects and pollinators. The flowers grow on a plant and bloom. They begin as flower buds, and they grow inside what are known as leaf axils. These are little angles that are formed between the base of a leaf and the stem. So the flower buds will grow in there, and initially they'll be very small, of course, and they will be surrounded by a layer of protective modified leaves, basically. So they're known as sepals, and we're going to have a look at sepals in a moment. And eventually the sepals will open when the flower is ready to blossom and bloom. It's not yet fertilized though, so this is only really the first stage in that reproductive process, but the flower will blossom, and this will mean that now the flower is ready to be fertilized. And once the flower is fertilized, it then develops into a fruit. The fruit contains the seeds, and the seeds will finally fall to the ground or be carried to new terrain where it can germinate, or they can germinate inside the soil to become a new plant. So flowers are very eye-catching. Often the petals are the most eye-catching part. They contain the reproductive organs of the plant, which must be protected initially until the flower is ready to be fertilized. Once fertilized, the flower can turn into fruit and release seeds, which then starts the whole new process again. Let's have a look at each individual layer in a whorl. Now, a whorl system, when you're describing flower anatomy, is based on the premise of there being four whorls in total, and working from the outside to the inside. The ones on the outside are more surface and more superficial, and the whorls towards the inside are becoming tighter and tighter, tightly nested to the inside of the flower. So this means that any whorls that are sitting on the outside of the flower are more exposed, and those that are sitting on the inside of the flower are more protected. So you might already be thinking now that the sepals I mentioned before would be the final whorl, and that's absolutely right, because the sepals play a protective role and they're sitting on the surface of the flowers. So the very first whorl from the outside in is the ring of sepals. Now, sepals often look like leaves because they are a type of modified leaf. They're modified to encapsulate the flower bud and to hold it and protect it, to seal in the moisture, so that the flower is protected until it is ready to open. And the sepals generally do stay on the flower. In some species, the sepals fall off. In a lot of the medicinal plants that you'll be using in your materia medica, the sepals do stay on. So that's probably more likely the case with a lot of the plants that you'll be familiar with. So these sepals are the outermost whorl. Together, all of the sepals are called the calyx, C-A-L-Y-X. So often if you see someone refer to the calyx, they're just simply using a different term, a shorter and simpler term, to describe all of the sepals. In some plants, the calyx can be modified. It doesn't always look like a modified leaf. And a really great example here is Taraxacum officinale, your dandelion. Dandelion produces very tiny florets. Florets are miniature versions of flowers, and the dandelion flower head is actually an inflorescence, so that's a different topic from today's. But dandelion combines many, many different florets into the one flower head. And each of those florets has its own calyx, but it's a very unusual calyx. It actually looks like a ring of string, little strings that form a parachute. So whenever you pick up a dandelion seed head and you blow on it to make a wish, and you see all of those little puff heads flying off into the distance, it's actually the modified calyx that is responsible for helping the dandelion seeds to be able to fly. So that's an example of a calyx which is modified for a very specific purpose there, to enable travel by air or by wind. In a lot of other plants, you'll find that the calyx is, sometimes it even looks like a petal. A lot of the lily family, for example, have a calyx that, or a set of sepals that is actually exactly the same as petals. It's very hard to tell which is which. So in that case, we call them tepals, meaning that they are both petal and sepal. And when you have a look at a tiger lily or a lily flower next time, just observe that, you know, you might think you're only seeing three whorls, but you're actually seeing a calyx and a ring of petals that are combined. So we know that the function of the calyx is for protection. Let's have a look at the next whorl. Now, the next whorl is the most showy whorl. Often in botany, the term showy simply means that something's very colorful or that it is quite dominating. And for flowers, usually the corolla is the most dominating whorl. This is not the case, though, for the tea tree species, for the eucalyptus species. So a lot of Australian natives actually have a different whorl, which is the most showy one. We haven't quite come to that whorl yet. But the petals in many flowers, you only have to think about, say, your lavender, for instance. The petals are definitely the most obvious and showy bit with their beautiful lavender color. Same with skullcap. Not the same with echinacea, dandelion, because even though you might think we're looking at pink and yellow petals in those instances, and in a sense we are, but we're actually looking at a set of petals, maybe three, five petals, and each of those making up a floret, tiny little flower. The corolla is the ring of petals. So while we call a ring of sepals a calyx, we call a ring of petals the corolla, and it is the second whorl. The function of the corolla is to attract and support pollinators. So in one sense, they will attract the pollinator to them by their color, and they will also support the pollinator's landing and adherence to the flower while pollination is taking place. In some instances, the color of a petal can be a warning sign. This is a very interesting doctrine of signatures approach as well, because the color of some toxic flowers represents that they contain certain phytochemicals that have a high toxicity. So an example of those would obviously be the alkaloids. They're very common in hallucinogenic plants or plants that have been used ritually throughout time to induce sleep and hypnosis and vomiting and transformation. You know, they've had herbal medicine has a very alchemical history. So with those flowers, we're looking at colors like blues and spotty black petals. You can think about flowers like belladonna, datura, the nymphaea species, the sacred Egyptian blue lily, and many more, of course. So the color of the petals could also be a warning sign to animals particularly, and also to insects to some degree, but mostly to animals, to let them know that if they graze too much on these flowers, or if they do happen to eat them, then they're likely to start feeling a bit giddy, a bit unwell. They might start to feel like they need to vomit. So they, this is nature's way of communicating, apart from many other strategies. This is just one way. So we have the calyx so far, the row of sepals, and we have the corolla so far as well, which is a ring of petals. So they are the two outer whorls. they're the most superficial ones. They're the ones that we tend to see. And they're the ones that, for the petals particularly, need to be obvious and visible to pollinators. The next two don't necessarily need to be visible to pollinators, so they tend to be held fairly tightly, like sacred little reproductive houses and systems, just like we have in our own bodies as humans. They tend to be held in little dark, secret, mysterious places. So we have the Andrecium, which is the male house. So Andrecium is composed of a number of stamen, and stamen are structures that produce pollen, and the pollen is then able to go on to fertilize flowers. The stamens each are composed of a long stalk, which is called a filament, and the filament attaches to it's called the anther, but it looks a little bit like a tiny version of a peanut, and it's just sitting and hovering and waving at the end of that filament. So the filament, in a sense, is there for support and positioning because it allows the anther, which is releasing the pollen, to rise high within the flower so that it actually has a chance to catch onto the wind, or it has a chance to rub itself all over a pollinating insect when it lands on the flower. Same could be said for a bird or any sort of bird or flying species that is landing on the flower, having a little nibble and a poke around. Perhaps it's a flower that contains a lot of nectar, so it might have a little bird that's coming to drink the nectar, and while the bird is doing that, the anthers will be rubbing their pollen all over the bird, and the bird will then travel to another flower where it rubs off the pollen, and the pollen goes on to fertilize that flower. So we have the Andrecium, the house of the male, composed of a number of stamen, and the stamen each being comprised of a filament and an anther. So far, most flowers will have a calyx and a corolla, but not all flowers will have an Andrecium. The Andrecium, therefore, needs to be there to ensure that the plant has the male parts. If a plant does not have an Andrecium, only the female parts, then it is called a female flower. It's also called an imperfect flower because it has only one of the types of reproductive systems within it. So it's not necessarily imperfect because it doesn't have the Andrecium. It's imperfect because it has incomplete number of whorls. And we know that the function of the Andrecium is to release the pollen. So the role of the filament is really, really crucial. And where this becomes very obvious is in flowers such as the tiger lily. A lot of you will be able to picture and visualize the tiger lily, but also in a lot of the native Australian tree species, such as the tea trees, where we have flowers which are composed mainly of very long and obvious stamen. So we look at these flowers, bottle brush is another really good example. We look at them and we think, wow, you know, that's a really interesting flower. And actually what we're admiring is the long, vivacious red stamen. So they are hugely formed to enable the best chance of releasing their pollen. Well, number four is the Gynecium, and the Gynecium is the female part of the flower. The Gynecium is really essential. We need the Gynecium to be able to house an ovary within the flower. So without an ovary, there really is no way for this flower to produce its seeds and to then enable the seeds to go into the ground and to germinate. There are, however, some plants that only have male flowers, meaning that they only have the Andrecium and they don't have the Gynecium. Where this tends to happen is where we have plants that are called dioecious. So nettle, I'm looking at my stinging nettle right now, and she's smiling back at me and saying, gee, it's hot outside today. So my stinging nettle, I'm not sure whether it's a male or female plant because I haven't really observed the flowers so much. I'm always, you know, cutting it back for the leaves. But there will be a male stinging nettle plant and there will be a female stinging nettle plant. It does make reproduction just that little bit more tricky because the male nettle and female nettle really need to be planted in close proximity to each other so that the pollen from the male plant can reach the stigma and ovary and the gynecium of the female nettle plant. Anyway, we've got the gynecium. We know it's the female part. We know that some flowers may have it and that in very rare cases, some may not. So what is the gynecium composed of? The gynecium in each flower will hold a pistil, and within a pistil, we can have a carpel or a number of carpels. What I mean by carpel is a set of three units that makes up the bulk of your female system within that flower. Each carpel is made up of an ovary at the base, a style, which is like a long stalk, so we're thinking along similar lines to the filament here, and a stigma at the top, which is very sticky. So the ovary sits down the bottom of the flower because it is the most protected part of the flower down there, so it's kept nice and safe. And within the ovary, we have a number of ovules. In some flowers, you might find that you have multiple carpels, so you have many of these sets of ovary-style stigma. So that could happen as well. In some plants, you can have multiple carpels, but it looks like you've only got one stigma at the top. That's the part you can see, so you're just making an assumption there that there's just one carpel. But in actual fact, the stigma will have a number of lobes on it, little points at the edges, and each of those points will tell you how many carpels are in that flower. That is possibly a discussion for a different audio cast, but for today I'm just going to leave it at the fact that the building blocks of the gynecium are these carpels, and each carpel is made up of an ovary style and stigma. So it's very important for the pollen to be able to find the stigma of a flower in order to pollinate it. So what has to happen then is the stigma needs to usually be situated quite high within the flower so that it is exposed to the elements. But often what happens with pollination is we can get the movement of pollen by air. That's with very, very light pollen. That's quite common with a lot of plants actually. But many of the medicinal plants that you'll be using will require pollinators. So the pollinator will pick up the pollen on one plant when it's fishing around the flower, carry it over to another plant or another flower, and the stigma, because it's so sticky, will latch onto the insect wherever it is, and it will pick up some of that pollen, and immediately then reproduction and fertilization begin. As I mentioned before, a flower may not necessarily have a female part, and it may not necessarily have a male part. So I think by now you've probably got a good understanding of a male flower and a female flower. If a flower doesn't have the female part, only the male part, it's also imperfect. Sometimes the term asexual might be used as well to describe a flower that does not necessarily have one of those important inner whorls, the gynecium or the andrecium. I think when I mentioned before that the function determines the form, I like to think about flowers as being examples of nature's brilliance in a way, because right in the middle of the flower, where everything is kept, cooler, darker, quieter, and it's obviously more protected, that this is actually where the ovules are being produced, which will become the eggs. So that's almost like the egg house. And then as we come out into the next well, we have the pollen house. And then in the next well, we have drawing the pollinators in. That's the corolla. And then in the final well, we have all parts being protected and held, given structure, given safety. And that's the calyx, the sepals. So it really is a brilliant organization, if you like, the way that flowers are organized. So just to conclude today, the key points are that in typical bisexual flowers, we have four whorls. We go from outer to inner normally when we're describing them. We start at the outer well, which is the calyx composed of all of the sepals. We go into the corolla, which is petals. And when we talk about the corolla and the calyx, sometimes the term perianth is used. This simply is a term that encompasses both the calyx and the corolla. So if I'm describing the perianth of a flower, I'm talking about its calyx and corolla. And then we come into the andrecium, which is the second innermost well, and then right into the innermost well, which is the gynoecium. And this is the female parts of the flower. And with terminology, a perfect flower is one that has all four whorls, whereas an imperfect flower is going to be missing one of those whorls, usually only missing one. Sometimes you might get a flower that misses more than one because there's such great diversity on this planet. But many of the flowers in the herbal medicine, Materia Medica, will usually be perfect flowers. And then the terms male flower and female flower are used to refer to flowers that are specifically lacking either a female house, gynoecium, or a male house, the andrecium. A really wonderful thing to do with flowers is to look at them very closely. So if you do happen to head out and you're wanting to observe all of these parts in a flower, take a little magnifying glass with you. Often you will need it. Flowers are very, very small. And, you know, in terms of looking at their anatomy, being able to actually see an ovary is really, really tricky. So you will notice that the petals and sepals normally are quite easy to identify. And by the time it comes to the ovary, sometimes even the style, that you're going to need to actually create what's known as a half flower. So you're going to need to dissect the flower vertically so that you can see all these different parts on the inside. I hope that you enjoyed today's audiocast, everybody. In the description, you'll find the APA 7th edition reference if you wanted to reference any of the information from this audiocast. Don't forget to have a look at that 5-minuter parts of a flower. There will be more 5-minuters as well available, so you'll be able to have a look at those as they come out. And sign up to our Vimeo channel and our YouTube channel so that you don't miss a botanical beat. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll see you next time.